don't have all our members here yet, but we are going to begin this meeting. I don't anticipate we'll be taking any votes. In the last couple of years, we passed some pretty stringent requirements on renewable energy and energy efficiency requirements. And so what we would like to do is to find out how we're doing in meeting those objectives. And so we will hear from the departments first, and then we will hear from the utilities so that they can fill us in on how things are going. And the first, you don't look like Mariah White. Welcome.
Madam Chair, Senators, staff, wanted to, first of all, introduce myself. My name is Bill Glahn. I am the Director of the Office of Energy Security and a Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Commerce. And on behalf of the Department and the Office of Energy Security, wanted to thank you for inviting us to appear before your committee this afternoon. I brought some of my staff people with me who I'll introduce in a moment. But just to recap what we're here for, we're here to report on how the state's utilities are doing in meeting, first of all, the renewable energy objective and the renewable energy standard that we have written into the law, and also how the state's utilities are moving toward meeting the 1.5% conservation requirement, the requirement that utilities conserve 1.5% of their retail load each year, and how we're moving toward implementing that. So with me today, I have Mariah White, who most of you would know. She is the manager of our regulatory staff and one of the authors of the report on renewable energy standard and objective, which I understood that was distributed to all the committee members. Also with me today are Jeff Haas, who is sitting behind me here. He manages the SIP program on behalf of the Office of Energy Security and reports to Janet Streff, who is sitting next to him here. I just wanted to say a couple of words of introduction for these two reports to put them in a little bit of context. And for the renewable energy report, the focus of the efforts, because it's the least cost, in most cases it's the least cost resource, is wind power. And just give you a couple of statistics that are not in the report, but a little bit of an update on where we are with wind energy in Minnesota. We have installed in the last 12 months, that is February 2008 through January of 2009. In the past 12 months, we have, according to our records, in Minnesota installed 428 megawatts of wind power in the last 12 months. And the last 100 megawatts of that is the second half of a project in Maurer County, the second 100-megawatt increment of a project. And this 100 megawatts was implemented in Maurer County on behalf of SEMPA, the Southern Minnesota Municipal Power Agency, with the first half, I think, was an Xcel NSP project. Thank you. And that's still being in the commissioning stages and still, but it's now beginning to be up and running and they're doing the testing. And so that's good news. But I did want to point out that more than a quarter of that, of the entire 400 megawatts, approximately 117 megawatts of that wind that's been installed in the past 12 months was community wind, seabed eligible wind projects, 117 megawatts in the last year. So I know that program was a little slow out of the gate and getting going, but we're now seeing significant investments and significant projects in the seabed community wind area. We are now in Minnesota up to 1,727 megawatts of total installed capacity of wind power in the state, which ranks us fourth in the country in terms of our wind resource that's been developed. Ranking behind Texas, California, Iowa, and Minnesota is fourth with 1727. On the conservation improvement side, again, a program that's been around for a couple of decades now, in the last 2 years, which we'll hear from Jeff about the results from actually 2006, 2007, 2008 data won't become available until the spring. So in those 2 years, we saved each year the equivalent of a 50-megawatt natural gas baseload plant. So that's 100 megawatts over the past 2 years. And just to put that in perspective, at least for me anyway, my former employer, the Minnesota Municipal Power Agency, built a plant in Chaska, Minnesota, a 50-megawatt natural gas plant in Chaska to serve the city of Chaska and the other members of the power agency. And SIP alone has saved the equivalent of two of those plants in a two-year period. And we'll hear more about the efforts, and I think there is a one-page handout to go along with the report that Jeff is going to speak about before. But first, I did want to say one more thing before Mariah begins with her report. You'll hear from Mariah and Jeff, I believe. You'll hear that we're making good progress in meeting, Madam Chair, what you mentioned, those two state mandates for renewable energy and for conservation improvement. We're making good progress in meeting what are very aggressive goals in each sphere, the 25 and 25, the shorthand for our renewable energy standard, and the 1.5% on the conservation improvement program. But I don't want to minimize what a tremendous effort on behalf of the state's utilities, their customers, and the state utility regulators that it will take going forward to meet these requirements. So, and I'm sure we'll hear that from my staff as well as from the utilities as we progress through this hearing. So, Mariah.
Thank you, Bill.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. We appreciate the opportunity to be able to present our RES progress report. As Mr. Glahn alluded, the stakes are high. You are absolutely correct, Madam Chair. Last year, you passed some very stringent requirements. However, the bottom line good news is that all of the utilities are stepping up to the plate and making good efforts. We've been actually, as we pulled together this report, we were comfortable telling you that we felt that they are making good efforts. We're in the beginning stages of our 25 to 25 for the state, but so far, so good. That's not to say there's not obstacles, and I actually will talk probably more about the obstacles just so you have a flavor of those than dwell on any individual company's report. If you will allow me, Madam Chair and members, I will just walk you through the report just to give you a very brief summary of what's in it. There's many pages I won't even touch, but we'll just do a brief walkthrough. I also will tell you that with us today, we have our rates analyst, Ms. Sue Pierce, who actually put the data together, gathered it from company reporting and various sources, talked to all the utilities, and put the report together and wrote it. So we're making our best efforts to try to answer any questions you may have about the report. With that, I'll just begin with the first page, with just basically the overview just gives you the bottom line. Good news is we're making good efforts. All of the utilities are making good efforts. Bad news, there are obstacles. And the good news is we're all working to address those obstacles, which I'll get into later. That's for page one. Page two and page three are a legislative history, which I certainly don't have to go over with you because you were the deciders. So I will move to page four and just mention a little bit and bring you up to date on number three, which is the use of renewable energy certificates to meet the RES requirements. One of the parts of the statute was enabling legislation, and in fact, it obligated the Public Utilities Commission to set up a program to track and trade renewable energy credits. And if I slip and use the acronym RECs, you'll understand what I'm talking about, renewable energy credits. I will tell you, and this is Ms. Pierce was integral in this as a Minnesota representative, that when we looked at, when we started the process, the commission staff and our staff started the process of looking at putting together a trading system and a tracking system, it made good sense to us to look beyond the borders of Minnesota. Seeing that the state of Wisconsin has their own RPS, Iowa has a type of RPS. Other states are looking for that. It made good sense to us to look beyond our footprint of our state. So we gathered together and collaborated with staff of Wisconsin, Iowa, and the two Dakotas, and the five states together put together what we call MRETS. It's Midwest Renewable Energy Tracking System. We contracted with APX Incorporated, which is a very knowledgeable consulting firm, which has put together these programs in the western part of the country. They know what they're doing, so that's who we hired in collaboration with the other states. And at the end of October of 2007, we had basically the structure put together. The commission approved it, and it went live. The commission also ordered all of the Minnesota utilities by March 1 of 2008 to register all of their renewable energy credits, which is a credit for their wind projects, their biomass projects, anything that's eligible. That was all done by March 1, 2008. The tracking system has been up since then and operating. When we put it all together, now right now it's just a tracking system. When we structured it, specifically to make sure that we could start a trading program, an active trading program where people could actually trade in this system. Right now, they look at the tracking system, they see what's available, they see what they want to buy, and they make private buy-sell situations. But we want to turn this into a trading program, and that's what we're looking at now. So Emirates has been a good success, it's up and running, and it's working. To our knowledge, it's working, and it's working among the five states. So just to bring you up to date, that's MRETS. Now on the next page, as we go through, number four, I wanted to just touch on a couple of things. In your statute, you talked about providing an ability to waive or extend the RES requirements for certain reasons, and they're listed on page five. There's two of them that I want to point out to you because I'm going to talk about them later. The two of them are number two, the effects of electric system reliability, and number six, transmission constraints. These are probably some of the biggest obstacles we have, and that's why I want to talk about them later. Another point I want to make with these is that at this point in time, when we look at certificates of need, which allow a large energy facility, a power plant, transmission line, pipeline, to be built, we always assume that the project proposers fully meet their RES obligation and fully meet their SIP obligation. We assume in these dockets that they do not waive anything. We hold them accountable for their full obligations. To date, no one's liked it, but no one's really fought with us or indicated a specific wish to waive anything.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to ask a question, if I might. On the list here, because you pointed out numbers two and six, I'm assuming there's some issues that you'd like to highlight. On the rest of the list, are we to assume that there aren't any, like, red flags with certain things that we should be looking at, like technical advances or utility costs where we've got some issues that we should be thinking about, or are they kind of going along as expected?
Ms. White.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator, we haven't heard anything about these other potential obstacles. Now it's still early in the program. They might surface. Part of the obligation for the report were for the companies to also tell us what they thought the obstacles were. And the number one obstacle universally that they talked about was transmission constraints. So that's why we focused on that. Along with transmission constraints, that it also impacts reliability. That's why I'm talking about these today. I'm not in any way thinking the rest are less important. They may end up very important. But for right now, for this report, it's transmission-related things.
Thank you.
Okay. I'm on page 6, going to page 6. And for page 6 through 13, this provides you with an overview of what is an eligible company, what types of companies are eligible for or obligated for RES. We give some overview. And then for the next few pages, we devote some space to each company, each eligible company, and their own situation. So the next 6 through 13 goes through each of the companies, and I won't go through each of the companies. You can take a look at them, and you're going to hear from some of them, I understand. So we'll let them tell their own story in any event. Okay, so I'm actually on 14, and this is where the obstacles and potential solutions are, and this is what I'd like to talk about a little bit here. I wanted to just focus on this because this is a real good news, bad news situation. The good news is everybody's making a good effort. That's the good news, and that's good. That's big good news. The bad news is this is not easy to comply. It's really not. This is taking a very traditional industry and having them look at their purchase of power, their building of facilities, tracking, accounting, everything differently. I'm not saying that's bad. I think that's good. But this is, they're really having to step up to the plate to look at this because it's all new, and they're doing it. So that's the bad news, but we're working to overcome it, and it's looking good. The next good news is that I can report to you, and this is because Mr. Seifert asked me yesterday a very good question, and Mr. Fuller did too, I think, about with all the wind energy that we are slated to build, have built, and slated to build, can we see if other energy generation facilities can either be put off for later or not built? So I went back and talked to my resource planning people, because that's where we would see such information, and they gave me two good examples. And that's all I asked for, because I don't want to bore you with stories forever and ever here, but I can give you one example.
We don't mind your stories.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One example is Xcel Energy. One of their latest IRPs, we asked them to do sensitivity runs, scenarios, and modeling with RES and without RES. So we can see when they forecast what their customers will need into the future and how it will be met, how it would be met if we did not have an RES and SIP, because remember, we model maximums for both of those in our resource plans. So if we did not have the RES, we did not have the SIP, how would they meet their customers' goals for the next 15 years? And then we have them model with the RES and with the SIP. We ourselves do independent modeling to be able to check that and to assure ourselves that we agree with whatever they come up with, or we don't agree, and then we take it to the commission and discuss it. Our own modeling in a recent Xcel case was that without the RES, we would probably need some certain, probably intermediate to peaking generation, which is usually natural gas, probably by about 2016. Just generically within Xcel's system. With the RES and the SIP included in their resource plan, they could put off having to build gas generation until after 2020. Now, Now, that's significant. Maybe 5 years doesn't sound significant, but that is significant. We're talking millions of dollars to build a facility, and then we're talking about purchasing natural gas on a competitive market, and we only, you know, the companies only have certain amount of control over their over being able to buy it. When they got to have it, they got to have it. So being able to put off a large gas plant, combined cycle gas plant, is significant when you can put it off for 5 years. An even more dramatic example is Great River Energy, a recent resource plan. Mr. Scarbacca, as I know, is here, and he's probably cringing right now, but it's a good example wherever you are, Glenn. looked at baseload. They needed baseload because Great River Energy is a growing area. This is like many of the suburbs. Great River Energy is my G&T supplier. They saw that to fulfill their growing customer needs, that they would need base load in a certain time period, and we're talking 40 years maybe. They found out for base load plants, we look at up to a 40-year time period because it can take 5 to 10 years to actually get one all the way through the regulatory process, purchasing, building, et cetera. They could put off this baseload plant, which we're talking billions of dollars for a baseload plant. They could put off the baseload plant for almost 9 years because of wind and SIP. I think that's very dramatic for customers. So that's the impact. That's the good news that I can share with you. Now, granted, this is all based on planning assumptions, but we have tested them to the best of our ability, and this is our findings based upon everything that we have.
Madam Chair.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wonder if you can translate that into how much savings consumers might expect. I mean, can you translate that into how much, what percent of rates that would mean that less that consumers will have to pay?
This way.
Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, I'm not sure I can do it like right here at the table, but let me take it back to my analysts
there
and see what we can come up with. And if we can come up with something that's logical, we'll provide you.
Great, thank you.
I can't guarantee, but I'll talk to them.
Okay.
So that's good news. Now, here we go for the bad news. Obstacles. The 2 to 3 greatest obstacles reported by the companies is, first of all, higher prices for steel and commodities. That's no surprise to anybody in today's market, even though with our...
That's actually good news, bad news with our iron range.
Exactly, exactly. Financing, especially in today's crazy financing market, is hard. When you're talking, you need millions of dollars for any major building, it's always hard to get financing. So those are very legitimate concerns. But the one I really want to concentrate on is the transmission and the reliability. This is where we at OES and the commission and the companies and everyone, almost every stakeholder in the industry that you talk to nowadays, not everyone, but almost everyone, agrees that we need more transmission. And we need it in certain places, and we need certain sizes of transmission that historically hasn't needed a lot of transmission because they've been rural, remote areas. Well, our rural, remote areas have the best wind resource. You all are familiar with Buffalo Ridge. That's exactly what's happened with Buffalo Ridge. There wasn't much transmission out there because it didn't need to be out there. But now we need it. So we're all working hard to shore up the transmission grid and to build more transmission. The other thing about reliability that I wanted to point out is that we all know that the wind doesn't blow all the time. Wind is an intermittent energy resource. Blows real hard, and then it stops, and then it goes up, and it goes down, and it goes up. That can play mess around with the viability of the grid. The utilities and the Midwest Independent System Operator and everybody are working very hard to figure out how to mitigate that impact on the grid, because we can't destabilize the grid. We're going to end up with blackouts if we do. But everybody is working on that very hard. It is a significant obstacle, and the more wind we put on the system, the bigger it is, the bigger obstacle it is. But everyone right now is expending significant resources and time to take care of this. And with that, Madam Chair and Senators, I'll quit talking. Thank you.
Thank you. Actually, that is what you've offered is very encouraging. I know that we have some problems, but hopefully we can work those out. Any questions? Senator Vanderveer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think another senator briefly touched on this, but do we have any measure of the impact on prices that this has done? Do we have any measure of that?
Madam Chair. Senator Vandermeer, are you talking about the comparison of wind prices versus another kind of energy price?
No, to the extent to which we begun implementing these standards, has it impacted prices at all?
Madam Chair, Senator Vandermeer, it may have increased them a little bit because energy is blocky. And what I mean is that when you build an energy facility, you have to build a bunch. You build a big bunch of energy, and then your load may not need it all right when it's built, right when it goes online, but it'll grow into it. That's what I mean by blocky. Blocky energy like that may increase prices. And so there probably is some increase in price. However, I think it's going to mitigate. Also, too, when we look at the integrated resource plans, most of our utilities, when we look at 15 years, most all of them do need energy over that 15 years. So what we make sure is that they fulfill as much of that energy need with the RES obligation and the SIP obligation before they look at fulfilling it with any other facility, like a gas plant or a baseload plant. So that's the way we're doing the planning, to try to match the RES obligation and the SIP obligation with the customer's needs over 15 years to 40 years.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I stepped out for just a minute to talk to a constituent. So you might have already talked about this, and if you have, we can talk later. But I was reading through on page 14 the obstacles and potential solutions, and they talk about the MISO queue reform moving at a slow pace. Is there anything we can do to help?
This way. Madam Chair, Senator Dibble, I'm glad you asked. You know, the reason we have a waiting line is because we have a short resource. And a short resource is transmission. If we had all the transmission we needed in the wind resource areas, we wouldn't have a waiting line at all. There wouldn't be such a thing as a MISO queue. And all of MISOs and the utilities engineers, transmission engineers, wouldn't have to do handstands to try to figure out how to hook up turbines to the grid when the grid's too little, you know, to take it without all kinds of handstands. That's exactly what's going on. So from OES position, you know, the more transmission we can get on the line, that's the best way to mitigate the grid mitigate the MISO queue situation. And that's what we're working on.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you. I agree completely. But also I've heard some discussion of some observation that it's really easy, especially for the independent developers, fall out of the MISO queue, for reasons that are unwarranted or unfair, highly technical and that necessarily won't slow down their ability to deliver. Is that actually the case? people feel like maybe they should be able to keep their – they fall out of the queue, get kind of put to the back of the line for reasons maybe they shouldn't be, or they should have some ability to appeal that. Is that true? I mean, I just don't know if that's true or not.
Sure.
Ms.
Madam
White.
Chair, Senator Dipple, I think what you're talking about is MISO recently applied to FERC. They are FERC-regulated, Federal Energy Regulatory Commission-regulated. They FERC recently approved a new way for them to operate their queue. And what they did was they set up a series of what they call milestones, but it's basically a to-do list. You have to have your paperwork done. You have to have a purchase power agreement. You have to have a number of things. You have to have your engineering done. You have to show that your, you know, your turbine is grounded. A whole checklist of stuff. And it seems like if everybody's got all of their to-do list done, they evidently can get through the queue pretty fast. But if they find out that some of their to-do list is not done, then I think that's when they fall out of the queue until they get it completed, and then they go back in. I think that's what you're talking about.
Thank you.
If I may continue, Madam Chair.
Go ahead, please.
Senator Dibble, before that time, the old queue process was that people did retain their place in the queue whether they had their homework done or not. And MISO found that they were spending a lot of time doing these people's homework for them in order to retain them, and it slowed up everybody behind them while MISO was doing the homework for them. So that's why they asked for this new way of doing it.
Wow.
And not everybody's happy about it, mm-hmm. but that's basically what's happening.
I suspect, Madam Chair, that's who we're hearing from.
That's
another perspective.
Dibble.
I appreciate
yes.
asking.
Although
the
before that we were hearing from the people who were being held up because the other projects were too slow moving forward.
Yep. In front of
and
them.
It was inhibiting our efforts to get the RES online. Mm-hmm. So.
Yep. Right. And, Madam Chair, they had a legitimate reason to talk because they were being held up.
Yes.
FERC had one way to do it. I mean, FERC. MISO had one way to do it that FERC had told them to do it, this one way. That's the only way they could do it because that's all that FERC told them. So, yes, it did help. It held up everybody who had their homework done behind the person who didn't have their homework done.
Okay.
Thank you.
Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. White, I wanted to follow back up on what you're talking about, the good news part, I guess, as far as the needs for baseload. And first question is the 9-year extension. Is that from what particular? Is that from today? They don't have to. The 9 years out from now, they're looking at a new plant, or some point in the future.
Madam Chair, Senator, that actually is planning into the future, and remember that these large baseload plants take 5 to 10 years to do. So when we're looking at large baseload, we can look anywhere from now to 15 years to 40 years out. Great River, this is not like right now. This is a certain time in the future to 9 years after that certain time in the future. Okay. And I'm sorry, I don't remember the date,
okay.
the year.
Right. And, Madam
Senator
Chair, the question or what I'm trying to get to, I guess, is if I remember what Commissioner Glantz said, it was a 50-megawatt plant per year that we're offsetting because of the energy savings that we're getting. And what I'm looking at is when are we going to need, as a state, another baseload plant, I guess, if we continue doing things as we're doing them right now and we're saving 50 megawatts per year, when are we actually going to need another plant in this state?
Ms. White.
Madam Chair, Senator, that's a harder question. I mean, it sounds like it's an easy question, but it's not because of the assumptions that you used. Let's just say that what I'm doing is thinking about all of the companies on the list in your report that have to do the RES, plus all the companies who have to do SIP, which Mr. Haas will tell you about. If putting all of those together, probably within the next decade, we're probably going to have to be looking at some kind of baseload energy, baseload facility, but I don't think it's going to be in, like, the next 5 years.
Senator Rosen. Oh, I'm sorry, Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Senator, I just wanted to follow up on that. I agree with Ms. White's assessment, but to just add a little bit more, I think we're going to see natural gas-fired peaking or perhaps intermediate plants proposed much sooner than that. So we'll probably see those in the next few years and a baseload plant a little farther out. Even with full implementation of the Renewable Energy Standard and the Conservation Improvement Program.
Thank you, Madam Chair, if I might. I'm just so I have Senator clarity on this, that that's we need to start planning for that, because since it takes 10 years to build one, within the next 5 years we need to get something started to go to have something built. Okay.
Madam Chair, Senator, I absolutely agree, and that's actually what we do with our resource plans, is planning for just that kind of thing.
Okay. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. White, in the area of wind, Iowa has several large facilities that are manufacturing wind, and I just read that, and I can't remember the location, Cedar Rapids perhaps, where they are laying off workers at the wind turbine production site. Do you know that if that is because there is less demand for the structures, or is it because of money the banks aren't lending? What is happening in that world?
Madam Chair, Senator, it was my understanding that I think it's a factor of the financing and the economy that we have right now. Excuse me. Also, the price of steel has really gone up. I think it was a number of factors. However, I can tell you that I don't think the demand for turbines has gone down. At least we haven't seen that it's gone down. But I think it may be in other parts of the country, perhaps it's like leveled off, so they haven't had they might have an inventory that they don't need as many workers. I hadn't heard that story, but considering financing, you know, the iffy kind of financing nowadays that everybody is, you know, everybody that needs a lot of money is experiencing. Unfortunately, it doesn't surprise me. I'm hoping that they hire those folks back and get going again.
Okay. Well, thank you for the report. And now we'll move on to the Conservation Improvement Program report.
Madam Chair, Senators, this is Jeffrey Haas from the Office of Energy Security.
Welcome.
Well, good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for having me. As Bill, Director Glahn said, is that all right? My name is Jeffrey Haas. I am the supervisor for the Demand Efficiency Unit at the Office of Energy Security, which is a unit that oversees SIP. It was kind of an attempt at rebranding SIP from SIP to Demand Efficiency that never took off, other than renaming our unit Demand Efficiency. We are responsible for reviewing conservation improvement program plans, status reports, modification filings, as well as reviewing plans and offering suggestions and recommendations for cooperative and municipal utilities, as well as investor-owned utilities in the state of Minnesota. In addition, we work with all utilities to try to improve the effectiveness of their programs, certainly looking at new program strategies, new technologies, with certainly with an eye towards the 1.5% savings goal that we're all anticipating and working very hard, as Director Glahn mentioned earlier in his opening remarks. All of our utilities are putting forth quite an effort to try to not only figure out how to reach the level of savings, but to increase the level of participation in their programs, which is ultimately a function of achieving greater savings. And that participation is certainly a challenge that we're dealing with going forward, I think. One of the key activities that our group is involved in is the review of assumptions and methodologies for claimed energy savings, and it's to that end that we've been working with utilities on the development of standardized assumptions for common conservation measures and the development of measurement and verification protocols for large projects that are rebated through utility programs. It's a two-pronged goal to not only achieve the 1.5% savings level, but to also ensure that those savings are as accurate as possible. In addition, we work to administer the conservation and applied research and development program, which administers grant funds that are assessed to the state utilities for applied research and development in the area of conservation. These funds are being used to identify new programs and strategies to help our utilities meet the 1.5% energy savings goals, both through identifying new strategies, but also identifying new implementation and ways of quantifying energy savings from energy conservation programs. In 2008, over $1.5 million was contracted for projects that will seek to identify new conservation potential in Minnesota. The Conservation Improvement Program and Energy and CO2 Savings Report that you have before you and the associated summary page covers the 2006 and 2007 program years. In those years, Minnesota's utilities spent approximately $206 million on SIP-related activities, achieving total annual total energy savings of 875,000 megawatt hours of electricity and 4 billion cubic feet of natural gas energy savings. This has resulted in more than 1 million tons of avoided carbon dioxide emissions. And this is approximately, as Director Galan mentioned, the amount of electricity that could be produced by a 100-megawatt power plant and enough gas to supply the annual needs of 40,000 homes. In addition, utilities spent approximately $7 million annually on programs to provide energy efficiency and conservation services to low-income customers. Program costs for that are borne by the SIP program are paid for out of ratepayer funds of the individual utilities, and anyone paying into those programs is eligible to participate. The ability of participation is somewhat a function of the opportunities that exist in any one customer's home or business. Historically, SIP projects have reduced electricity consumption in Minnesota by approximately 0.8% annually out of an estimated growth rate of 2.3% without SIP. And certainly the Next Generation Energy Act of 2007 strengthened Minnesota's commitment to energy savings, establishing an annual savings goal of 1.5%. The CO2 savings associated with SIP were calculated first by compiling the total annual electricity and natural gas savings reported by each utility in 2006 and 2007. And then total annual CO2 savings were calculated by multiplying the savings by the appropriate emissions factors. In this case, the most recent CO2 emissions factor from the for the Midwest Reliability Organization was used for the region that amounted to approximately 1,810 pounds per megawatt hour and 121 pounds of CO2 per 1,000 cubic feet based on the chemical composition of natural gas.
Those numbers again? What?
The numbers are 1,810 pounds of CO2 per megawatt hour and 121 pounds per 1,000 cubic feet of natural gas. These are figures that are reported annually by the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency to the Minnesota Department of Commerce and the Public Utilities Commission. It's important to note that the energy and CO2 savings reported are incremental That is that the savings achieved in 2006 will occur again in 2007, and all savings from the first year will occur throughout the lifetime of the measures that are rebated or incented through the utility programs. The first-year energy savings are based on the life of the high-efficiency measures, which in most instances averages about 10 years. There are some measures that have longer lifetimes than that and some measures that have shorter lifetimes. But for many of the common efficiency measures, the energy savings and the associated CO2 will be realized for approximately 10 years following the installation of the project. Excuse me. The savings levels shown for 2006 and 2007 represent utility activities prior to the passage of the Next Generation Energy Act, where utilities were focused on achieving a desired level of spending. Meeting the 1.5% energy conservation goal will require a tremendous increase in program activity, as can be seen in the bar graphs that are shown in the summary handout that you have. The 2010 goal, which is calculated based on our 2005 energy, utility data book, total energy sales less the amount of sales to exempt customers under SIP, is equal to approximately double the 2007 achievements, and it's about 2.5 times the 2007 achievements for natural gas. The CO2 savings associated with this level of savings will increase by approximately the same factors. SIP is certainly SIP and conservation, I should say, provides somewhat of an elegant solution to some of our energy needs. Not only is it a way of reducing our demand, but it's a way of reducing our demand in a way that's time sensitive. That is to say that to the extent that we can implement energy conservation and energy efficiency activities, we realize those savings in efficiency and conservation today. So there's a much quicker timeline that we're dealing with versus the other sources of meeting our supply needs. That is not to say that these are always slam dunk opportunities. Certainly, I believe that you'll hear from some of the utilities here shortly about some of the challenges that they've been faced with as they've been working with their customers to implement projects in an environment where capital is of the utmost importance and projects may be delayed regardless of the payback that they could be achieved. In all instances, participation on the part of the customer is required. The utilities are there to provide incentives to try to make them go with efficient options that conserve their resources. But ultimately, it comes down to customer choice that is based on their own economic considerations. And sometimes that can be a challenging obstacle to overcome. Thank you for your time, and I'll be able to answer any questions you may have on this program.
Thank you. Are there questions? Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a couple of quick questions. One is you mentioned that most of the efforts under SIP have a shelf life of about 10 years or so, mm-hmm. Which is great. What happens after 10 years? Like, I assume, for example, there'd be a SIP rebate for an energy-efficient appliance, and it lasts for 10 years, and you have to go buy a new appliance, a new
sure,
washer or dryer.
Sure.
Does the utility effort then get recognized that second time towards its goal? I, the answer may be obvious, but it's not entirely obvious to me.
Mr. Hutz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Dibble, it's hard to say. Sometimes it's hard to consider someone regressing in terms of the efficiency level that they've had in place. I don't know. There's certainly an opportunity for the customer to participate in another program. that would potentially increase the efficiency level beyond what they were even at. But what we often struggle with is in the analysis of energy savings, you're dealing with both baseline conditions, which would represent the least efficient option, and then the energy efficient option is what utilities are trying to rebate the customers with. It all depends on where they started from as to whether or not they will be able to be eligible for another rebate going forward. And that baseline condition determines what their energy savings might be. And it's those energy savings that will determine whether or not a program is cost effective for a utility to provide an incentive or a rebate to. Certainly, it's our hope that market transformation takes place and that the customer becomes educated about the economic payback and the economic considerations related to the higher efficiency products or equipment. But it's all going to be fairly dependent on the individual conditions of a specific scenario.
Did you have a follow-up question?
I have a couple of different questions, if I may. If
you Senator Dibble.
Thank you. In the Demand Efficiency Act, there was a direction to the PUC to work with voluntary utilities to maybe look at rate decoupling. How far along has that come? I believe it's only the natural gas company that's interested. I'm wondering why the electrical companies are not interested. And A and B, how far along has that consideration of that pilot come?
Madam Chair, Senator Dibble,
Mr. Hess.
I know the OES is involved in those proceedings, and they're being carried forward by the PUC. I don't know that. I don't know if Ms. Gonzalez would be able to come up and speak to that.
I'd like to hear, if she has 60 seconds, that would be.
Yeah, Ms. Gonzalez, if you can help us out.
Here's the bus.
Thank you. I guess I didn't successfully hide behind the pillar. My name is Janet Gonzalez. I'm the manager of the energy unit at the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission. Madam Chair, Senator, I brought a number of orders and things. I don't think I brought quite the right thing for that. We started looking at decoupling pretty soon after the legislation was passed. The commission hired a group to help us. It's called RAP, Regulatory Assistance Project. They've done a lot of decoupling and other type of work around the country. Most of them are ex-regulators who help regulatory commissions. They held some workshops and submitted a report to the commission in, I believe, June or July of last year. We sent that out for comment. There are a number of – we had a wide variety of comments. I've had one of my newer staff people working on trying to summarize them and figure out how to bring this to the commission, and so far she covered about a whole wall with her outline, so I asked her to see if we could get that down a little more. The commission is planning to – so we have quite a lot of information. We have a wide variety of opinions from different interest groups, some of whom say, go for it right now, some of it who say that's not a good idea, and most of whom are somewhere in the middle where that it can be a good idea with the proper conditions. We're intending to bring the matter for the commissioner's decision sometime likely in early April. You might also want to be aware that there is a proposal in a pending Central Point Energy rate case for a decoupling program.
So,
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So do we know why the natural gas companies are more interested and the electrical companies are less interested?
Madam Chair, Commissioner
Ms.
Dibble,
Gonzalez.
I think it depends. I think you can ask them. I believe one of the reasons that natural gas companies would be more interested is this particularly decoupling, particularly, I don't know if benefits is quite the word I want to use, but it's particularly important, I think, for revenue. It's basically a revenue stability mechanism. And natural gas companies in general are facing declining use per customer, and this would help stabilize that declining use. It would help stabilize their actual earnings, even though use is declining. Where electric companies aren't in general facing, they may be facing declining use for certain applications of electricity, but they're not generally facing individual decreases in usage because of all the fancy electric gadgets that everyone has. And so I think that is part of it, not so much on the conservation aspect of it, but on the revenue and earnings. It's more of an earnings and revenue stability aspect. Is I would suspect the natural gas companies are more concerned about that. Decoupling would do more than just, depending on how it's implemented. There are different ways to implement it. But a broad decoupling mechanism also takes into account weather variations. I mean, you would decouple revenues from weather variations. It wouldn't just capture conservation. I mean, you could do it so it would just capture conservation. But it, in its, I don't know if you'd call it pure form, but in its complete form, it would cover those a number of issues, and that's probably in general of more concern to natural gas companies.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Dahl, were you finished?
Oh, wait, I'll let someone else.
Okay. Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Haas, I wanted to, I don't know if you, how much you touched on this, but on the deemed savings database, talk about that a little bit. I'm intrigued by this idea of having a some sort of a testing facility here that's, you know, could be the center for the energy efficiency movement. What I'm wondering is there's this idea that I'm reading through this thing. It's talking about that a lot of the engineering calculations used to determine the energy savings are maybe the validity is called into question because of different things. And I know there are, at least I understand that there's companies like Honeywell, Johnson Controls that are already doing this type of thing with public buildings, measuring the savings, maybe even putting, you know, there's name on the dotted line saying we'll guarantee these savings. I mean, how can we use OES to be able to, you know, move this thing forward so that we know that there's the savings we're generating are quantifiable, that we can now take that to say, you know, the financial market to get the capital we need to get into these the homes or buildings to say, here, we're going to create these kind of savings so you can invest in these projects and know that you're going to get a return on them. How can your office help facilitate that?
Mr. Haas.
Madam Chair, Senator Dahl, well, I believe, you know, we're trying. We're moving down that road. And with the deemed savings, for instance, as a lighting project, one can look at changing out your T12s to a T8, going to higher efficiency lighting. The hours of operation drive the amount of energy savings that are associated with that project. And the hours of operation are going to vary depending on the type of building that the lighting project is being installed in. An office building, for instance, has very different hours of operation than a school facility or a warehouse. What our deemed savings database tries to capture is by providing standard assumptions for the use or for determining what the energy savings will be from any one of these any one of these projects, and for instance, you know, there's a lot of variation even among any particular conservation measure or energy efficiency measure because of variations in usage. On the extreme side, if you wanted to capture all of the energy savings associated with that measure, you could put a meter on it and have that meter feed back to the utility, and you would have the number of hours or the number of energy savings over the course of a year. That is relatively cost prohibitive, and so we have to rely on a certain set of assumptions for a number of our common projects. The Energy Service Corporations, which I believe you're talking about with Honeywell and Johnson Controls, they're in the business of kind of going through these calculations on their side and coming up with a financing package that works for the customer in that case, depending on the number of the payback from energy savings, mm-hmm. Which is slightly different. I think it's a nuanced difference, but. What we're trying to do with the deemed savings database is develop a standard savings assumption for utilities to use going forward. The ESCOs and some of the work that they do, I think, will continue to happen, and that is something that happens more on the financing side rather than what is reported back to the energy utilities.
Madam Chair.
Senator Dahl, I think that the Center for Energy and the Environment does some of those calculations and conservation.
And Madam Chair, I was thinking a lot of these things, it seems as though that we know we can calculate a lot of this already, and that, you know, especially from, you know, our environment and our buildings, that, you know, your office helped me to sit in that energy auditing course, and basically it's, you know, the physics are there. It's like BTUs in, BTUs out. They can calculate a lot of this stuff down to, you know, the degree of the BTU going in and out. So there shouldn't be that much variability, and yet the stumbling block here is, and maybe that's where the OES can help out, is to the education part, especially for the financing sector of our community, to help us get capital and into those areas where we need it. Say, again, I'm thinking of the residential sector, that we need to get those money into those contractors' hands to do the upgrades, and yet they have to know that there's a quantifiable return, and I'm not sure they're able to know that there is that savings, and maybe your office can help to bring that information to them. We already have some models like Honeywell that says it's working in the public sector with schools or wherever else. Can we use that same model and get that out to the financing arm of our community to help us get capital, release it, to know that there is a way that they can make an investment package out of it? Can you help with that?
Deputy Madam Chair, Senator, I'll take a crack at this. I know we are looking at some ideas to do more automation to create a common database for all the utilities to use, where we can capture a lot more of our information in one place on what measures work, how much savings they produce. I know our weatherization folks, which Jeff isn't involved in, they do a before and after test of the measures they go and do when they when they put in more insulation or change in a furnace. So we have a database through our weatherization folks. We're trying to come up with solutions where we have data in a single place that different stakeholders can access to prove up some of these things, and working with our contractors on the weatherization, our utility providers, to have that information out there. And I do know that the financing is a big obstacle to implementing many of these things, but we're committed to working with folks to come up with we hope it'll be a technological solution of that, so we can prove up these savings and have them be financeable and have projects move forward.
Thank you.
Senator Dibble.
Thanks. Just wanted to ask a question about what we're seeing come in the door, because I don't think yet we have a kind of transition to the new SIP. We have the plans coming in now, mm-hmm. From the utilities. So I'm wondering, and I know that we developed, what do we call them, off-ramps and soft landings in the legislation, so 1.5 is too aggressive. we're letting folks come in at something less than that. Are we seeing that happen, A, and B, what kinds of things are the utilities proposing to do? Or we might be hearing from the utilities themselves.
We will be hearing from them.
I'm hoping it's a range of...
Maybe you can give us some general statements.
It's not just the old-fashioned, just the appliance stuff, but
we
have the whole continuum from generation to transmission to end-user ideas as well as market mechanisms.
Mr. Haas.
Madam Chair, Senator Dibble, I hope to give you a little preview of what the utilities might say. Hopefully I'm not way off. One of the things, or actually several of the things that were included in the Next Generation Energy Act are elements like behavioral programs as well as energy utility infrastructure programs that seek to save energy by reducing the losses within the distribution system. Behavioral and market transformation programs are kind of challenges in quantification because there are areas that we haven't really kind of ventured down in the past. When we had been operating under a spending requirement, it was really, you know, we did education and we tried to change behavior, but there wasn't really an onus on quantifying what that meant in terms of kilowatt hours saved, and then bringing that into the utilities' achievements. We have a number of projects that look very promising, and Otter Tail Power has recently in their approved SIP plan covering the 2010 year has a couple of unique programs. One is a kind of an overall community energy pilot that is going into a single community and really trying to do a blitz on that community and try to institute energy conservation throughout every aspect. It's as much of a marketing and implementation strategy as it is getting people to it's really a strong marketing and implementation strategy in that area. They also are working on a program to do builder operator certification, which would provide training to building operators so that they know how to better run a building, kind of the fighter pilot of a building and they're working on not only instituting that program and getting the training in place, but also the subsequent measurement of the achievements. And there are a number of building operator certification programs have been around for a number of years, and the Northeast Efficiency Program and the Northwest Council have been very active in those, and there are some studies that we can at least pull numbers from to say that at least for the purposes of the program at this point, we can make the assumption that there will be 15 to 20% energy savings based on participation in that program. Going forward, how we do the subsequent measurement of those activities and really verify it will help, provide somewhat of a feedback loop so that we can continue to become more and more accurate in those type of programs going forward.
Okay. Thank you. Thanks.
Senator Anderson, and then I'd like to move on to the utilities.
Yeah, Madam Chair, this is mostly just a comment, but I'll ask if you have any more information about it. I'm just thinking about the federal stimulus bill, and the proposal includes a number of energy efficiency investments, appliance rebates, and weatherization of homes, and money to do efficiency improvements on public buildings. So I'm wondering if you guys are tracking that, and maybe we can ask the utilities to respond to that, too. It seems to me that could really help enhance the work that is being done in Minnesota and help the utilities meet their goals. Do we know anything about that?
Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, we're tracking it very much so, and certainly when we're looking at how we might be able to get a large amount of money out to consumers, the utility programs do offer something that's out there as far as a mechanism that has worked for going on 3 decades now. And I think we're certainly interested in how we might be able to partner with the utilities on those efforts to not only, you know, get the money into the customers' hands, but also help the utilities meet their goals.
Well, and Madam Chair, just on that briefly,
Senator Anderson.
I mean, I don't know what the average refrigerator rebate is from a Minnesota utility, but it's probably $100 or a couple hundred bucks at most for a $1,000 refrigerator. But if the feds would match that and come up with another couple hundred, you know, then maybe someone like me would consider it. I mean, that makes a huge difference, and it could really enhance what they're doing because there's just not enough. Sometimes it's not enough to really get consumers' attention.
Sure.
Actually, maybe Ms. Streff has more information about that.
We do have
information about $2 billion in energy efficiency research and demonstration and deployment. There is also $32 billion, I think, for new transmission. This is in the area of the RES, that for new transmission and smart grids and things like that. So did I say billion? It was billion. But so the significant investments, provided these packages come through Congress and are signed by the president. So I don't know, Ms. Streff, do you want to add anything else?
Hi, my name is Janet Streff. I manage the State Energy Office in the Department of Commerce. The numbers that we understand that are in the Senate versus the House for money that could possibly come through our office, I get two as well, very. In the Senate, they were much lower and provided $500 million versus $3.4 billion on a national level, which could translate from approximately $9 million to $60 million. And so it's hard to construct a program at this point. I also know that the Senate is entertaining a separate program that would, in fact, provide money for matches for utility conservation programs in states. So that, I believe, is in the Senate bill as well, and we aren't sure where either of them will end up.
Well, Madam Chair, I guess I'll be really interested to ask the utilities how they're going to take advantage of that. It sounds like it's a real opportunity that this year, as soon as the money's released, to really rev up their efforts.
Okay.
So we want to make good use of that.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
And now we'll move on to some of those updates from the utility companies, and we'll start with Jeff Daugherty from CenterPoint Energy. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, Senators. My name is Jeff Daugherty. I'm the Director of Regulatory and Legislative Activities for CenterPoint Energy's Minnesota Gas Operations, and it included my responsibilities of the company's conservation programs. We were asked to address you today on an update on our conservation program activities, in particular how it pertains to the 2007 Next Generation Act. I thought before we start about talking about where we're going to go, I thought spending a few moments on where we've been would be helpful. I'm talking from a PowerPoint presentation that I believe you folks do have. On page 2, we've summarized just briefly where we've been in the 16 years that we've been offering conservation programs in Minnesota. We've spent over $100 million on conservation programs in Minnesota. Historically, about 47% of those dollars have gone to residential customers. In the recent years, it's been split about 50% residential customers and about 50% to our business customers. As far as participants in our program, the vast majority of our participants are our residential customers. About 90% of our customers are residential customers that participate in the program. And as far as energy savings go, we have saved over 10 BCF of gas on our conservation programs. That, just to give you a context, that's equivalent to the annual residential heating use for residential customers in Minneapolis. And most of our savings come from our large and our commercial businesses. Approximately 80% of our savings come from those customer groups. On page three, I've tried to capture for you a little bit of the efficiencies that have been realized in our system for quite a few years now. I believe it was mentioned earlier today to you that we have realized a declining use per customer in our system for many years now, and the graph on the left illustrates that decline. From about 1986 to 2007, we've realized about 2% decline each year on our residential use per customer. To help put this in context a little bit for you, on the right-hand side, I've given you some statistics. In the 10-year period from 1997 to 2007, our customers, we have added 142,000 customers to our distribution system, nearly all those in the residential and small business sector. However, for the same period of time for those customers, which represent about 75 to 90% of our natural gas throughput in our system, our throughput load has remained flat at 118 BCF a year. At the same time, you know, as a natural gas utility in the state of Minnesota, we have an obligation to serve. When customers want to have natural gas, we have an obligation to bring that natural gas to them, and we have invested over $440 million in the state of Minnesota in that same 10-year period of time. So I share this with you to illustrate that there have been many efficiencies in our system, both those driven by us and those driven by just the marketplace, and to indicate that it should be no surprise to folks when we have to come in and ask for general rate increases when our load is basically staying flat, yet we invest $440 million in the state of Minnesota. On page three, just starting to transition just a little bit to the objective that was set in the 2007 Energy Next Generation Act. And that objective was tailored around energy savings, which I think was appropriately so. Before, we had a spending goal, and that really isn't quite the objective we're trying to achieve, and that was energy savings. For CenterPoint Energy, we have historically saved about 0.6% of our throughput on an annual basis, with a high of 0.8% and a low of 0.35%. The objective set before us is to try to achieve 1.5%, and that is going to be a significant hurdle and a jump for us to do. And so what we are doing is trying to figure out how we're going to fill that gap. I'll touch base on that just briefly. What we are doing, we have gotten together with Xcel Gas and Minnesota Energy Resource Corporation to do a natural gas potential study for the state of Minnesota. I am told that there are not very many natural gas potential studies done around the country, so we're kind of plowing new ground here. And we have hired Navigant Consulting to help do the work, and we have also hired American Council for Energy Efficient Economy, ACEEE, to be advisors to us as we try to discern this information. What a potential study does, beyond just the obvious of trying to tell you what is the potential energy savings that can be achieved, what it does is takes a look at how natural gas is used in this state, the technologies that are in place, and the technologies that could be used to help customers be more efficient with our product. It takes a look at the history of conservation, and then it takes a look at the costs to deliver these energy conservation potentials. Now, just this last week, I received the first draft of this potential study, and I read it over the weekend, and it's 170 pages long, and that's before I get to all the attachments and everything. So suffice it to say, I've dog-eared many of those pages and have a lot of questions. And so while I'm not at liberty to get into all the details yet until we've had an opportunity to work through it with our utility partners and those who are advising us, I do have some high-level observations I'd like to share with you just briefly this afternoon. The first observation is that it appears to me that there's a potential for more energy savings. However, the marginal cost to achieve those incremental energy savings appears to be significantly more expensive. That means that I think now we have to go back and we have to understand what the costs are that are driving that, but we also have to take a look at other factors, including the impact on customers who do not participate in these programs. It appears that there will have to be some policy changes for us in order to achieve these incremental energy savings. Most of these policy changes, I think, are more on the regulatory side of the equation, not necessarily require statutory implementation, but there are things that we're going to have to look at and work with the Office of Energy Security on those types of matters. And it also appears that there's going to be a phase-in in order to achieve incremental energy savings. These are, as I believe Mr. Haas indicated, these are marketing programs. You have to have distribution channels in place. You have to change customer behavior, and you just can't flip a switch and make that stuff happen. So it will have to be a phase-in period to achieve these energy savings. And finally, we believe that it will be very important to continue to work to remove the disincentive for the utilities to partner and try to achieve these incremental energy savings. Madam Chair, that's the end of my testimony. I'm available for questions.
Mr. Dougherty, are you at liberty to say what policy or regulatory changes you think might be necessary?
Madam Chair, we have a couple things that just come to my mind. And again, this is a 170-page study. I'm going to have to spend more time with it. I think one of the items that we have to take a look at is historically for us as a natural gas utility, each individual piece of technology would be measured on whether it is cost effective. We may have to take a look at how we bundle some of these projects together. There may be a certain part of technology that if you rebate is not cost effective on its own, but if you bundle it with something else that is extremely more cost effective, it is still a cost effective proposition. So we're going to have to take a look at that as a potential. I think that what we're hearing from our trade allies and from our customers is concerns and about the amount of data that has to be collected. I think I agree that we need to make sure these energy savings are real, but if data collection is a burden to customers and a disincentive for them to participate, I think we have to explore those. Madam Chair, those are a couple things off the top of my mind.
Okay. Senator Dipple.
Thank you. And when you say remove disincentives for participation, are we talking about rate decoupling there? Is that what that alludes to?
Madam Chair, Senator, that's correct.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Next, I'd like to call on Lee Sundberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Lee Sundberg with the Minnesota Rural Electric Association. We provide services for 44 distribution co-op and 6 generation and transmission co-ops that provide service to roughly covering 85, maybe up to 90% of the geographic area of the state. And the rural distribution co-ops range in size from 2,000 to 122,000 with a median size of 6,400. The 6 generation and transmission cooperatives are responsible for the renewable energy standard, and the 44 distribution co-ops are responsible for the conservation improvement program, but they are allowed to aggregate with the generation and transmission cooperative that serves them. So on the one extreme, we have one G&T that provides service and SIPS assistance to one rural electric cooperative with 2,900 customers. And on the other extreme, we have Great River Energy that provides service to 28 distribution cooperatives and about 635 1,000 customers. So quite a range or a gap there. On the renewable energy standard, speaking broadly and in general terms for all of them, and the Great River Energy and Dairyland have folks here that will speak more specifically to each. We're, I think, clear based on the report that Mariah White gave that we are all the 6 generation transmission cooperatives are at or exceeding the renewable energy standard. And some will even be in a position to bank. They can bank for up to 4 years or sell through that MRETS program that Mariah spoke of. Even though we're looking positive, we too have some concerns, most all of which have already been mentioned and will be touched on in a little more detail. More transmission, financing, resource commodities cost, the wind blows, the wind doesn't, the intermittency blows when you don't need it. And one other concern, too, that I'd like to mention is that the possibility of additional state mandates, which raises issues or potential issues of cost effectiveness and efficiency in achieving that 25% mandate. On the conservation improvement program, again, where the co-ops, all of the co-ops, all 44 with their associated generation transmission cooperatives are planning and have taken steps to implement the SIPS law, the 1.5% kilowatt hour savings annually. And there again, though we too have some few concerns about it, but we are talking with the Office of Energy Security, and Gary will talk more about that, and Kenrick. One includes the decreased usage with the recession. We don't quite know how the economy is going to work or not, and plus the decreased annual consumption with the Conservation Improvement Program, we could have a diminishing consumption that would be difficult even for a nonprofit organizations like us to withstand the business pressure if it weren't for, and thank goodness for, the exclusive service areas. But it would put considerable pressure on rates. The recession makes it harder for individuals, for residential, commercial, and industrial, for customers to invest in conservation. I think we've heard plenty that there could be lots of stimuli to help that, but without it, makes it more difficult. And two, co-ops are mostly residential, a few commercial, industrial customers, and it's more difficult to gather sizable kilowatt-hour savings. And finally, I know the office is going to get sick of me here saying this all the time, is how do we deal with education, training, and other indirect programs, behavioral changes, or spending for behavioral changes for the 2010 looks like doesn't count since it's not a direct project saving. So just some questions and concerns. I think there's still room for further discussion about those. And with that, Madam Chair, Mr. Connett could address unless there's some comments or questions.
Okay. Mr. Connett.
Madam Chair, Senators, my name is Gary Connett, and I'm the Director of Demand Side Management and Member Services for Great River Energy. I wanted to mention just briefly that Great River Energy, as Lee said, serves 28 distribution cooperatives in Minnesota, from the Arrowhead region in northern Minnesota up the Gunflint Trail all the way through the metro area and down to the southwestern part of Minnesota. So it's a real diverse service territory. 28 member co-ops. I might also mention that 8 of those member co-ops have fixed their purchases from GRE, and they purchased their additional growth from another G&T called Basin Electric in North Dakota. Great River Energy has really had a history of really being proactive in the area of what's called demand-side management, and maybe some of you have heard the word demand response today. It's really about reducing our loads during peak times, and if you were to look at Great River Energy's load curve, you'd realize why we do it. We have a very peaky load curve, and it's because we serve predominantly residential customers. And so for about 20 years, my focus has been really on demand response programs, and we've done a great job on it. More recently, particularly since 2007, we've started to have a real emphasis on conservation. And we've broken the conservation goal, if you will, into two pieces. It's a 1.5% goal, but we see it as two pieces at Great River Energy. The first piece is the 1%, and I like to think of it in terms of it's on the customer side of the meter. And I'll have to say I have responsibility for that with my 28-member co-ops. The way that we get that is we do it through rebates. And if it doesn't get a rebate, we don't know about it, and it doesn't get counted. So that's how critical rebates are for us to capture all the energy savings that's on the customer side of the meter. That's the 1% goal we have. We also have the 0.5% goal. That's the system improvement goal. That's the side on our side of the meter, if you will. And I'm not responsible for that. I like to think I'm not. At Great River Energy, that's going to fall on our generation people, on our transmission people, and to some degree on our distribution co-op people that have responsibility for the system. And so I'm working with that groups, or those groups, if you will, in terms of meeting that 0.5% goal. And literally this year, we have to put that in place. We have to find out what programs qualify as system improvements, catalog those sort of efficiency improvements, and make sure that we're capturing all that by the year 2010. And one of the things that we're doing is we've scheduled a meeting with all of our distribution co-ops and the Department of Commerce to talk about some of those sort of things. I've given out a handout, and I hope that maybe you found it in your packet of information. It's about 3 pages long, double-sided, and on the top of the second page, I wanted to give you a status, if you will, in terms of how we're doing on meeting the goal. And after all, that's what I was asked to come down and speak to. I've shown 2004 through 2010, and as Mr. Haas mentioned, prior to 2007, it was a spending goal. And we're pretty good at spending money and would always meet the goal pretty handily. In 2007, it became an energy savings goal. And in 2007, we started implementing a plan to get us to that 1%, if you will, the energy that we have to save on the customer side of the meter. And so our plan showed that in 2007, we are going to get halfway there, 50%. And by the way, I might mention, how much energy does GRE have to save to meet the goal? It's 111 million kilowatt hours on the customer side of the meter and about 56 million kilowatt hours on the system side of the meter. All total, about 167 million kilowatt hours each year. I've broken it into two pieces. We're after the 1% on the customer side of the meter, and that's what my chart shows on the top of page two. In 2007, I wanted to get to 50% of that goal. In 2008, I wanted to get to 0.7. 2009, 0.85, and 2010, 1% were there. And then thereafter, we have to do 1% every year. To make that goal in 2007, we had to save 56 million kilowatt hours. And by golly, we saved 58 million kilowatt hours, and we're at 0.52%, just slightly over the goal that I had set for myself. In 2008, our goal was to get to that 0.7%, which was 78 million kilowatt hours, and we saved 111 million kilowatt hours. We actually already achieved the 1% goal in 2008 that we're set to make in 2010. Now, I have to quickly caution that 25% of that goal came from three jobs, three big projects, if you will. And I suspect, if you listen to some of the other utilities talk, particularly those utilities that have a lot of large commercial and industrial loads, you'll see some characteristics like that. A lot of the energy savings opportunities come from large commercial and industrial loads. If you have those sort of loads, you might have a better chance of making the goal year after year after year. If you don't have those sort of loads, it might be more of a challenge. I might mention for Great River Energy, we do serve predominantly residential customers. And so I think it will be more of a challenge for us to meet that goal year after year. But we're committed to it. In terms of recent action that we're taking to help us succeed in the goal, there's a number of things that we're doing, and I've listed them, and I just want to share a few of those with you. For example, we've increased our rebates from literally $3 million in 2004 to about $10 million in 2009. We arranged a meeting with all the utilities in the state of Minnesota and invited them to Great River Energy to talk about partnership opportunities for meeting this goal. We had investor-owned, we had municipals, we had co-ops, and it was just the utilities there talking about what can we do together to meet this goal. And it's my responsibility to pull some of those people back together and see if we can't formulate some sort of partnerships. We created a relationship with Walmart stores. 34 of the 61 Walmart stores in Minnesota provided an instant store markdown on compact fluorescent lights. It's something that Walmart doesn't do with every vendor, but they were comfortable doing it with us. We've created a relationship with General Electric, and General Electric doesn't do this very often as well. And we implemented a coupon strategy where member consumers could receive a discount on any GE CFL anywhere in our service territory where GE bulbs were sold. Lastly, we created a relationship with Best Buy Company on appliance rebates. And Best Buy actually contributed to the rebates as well. They put in $25 on the refrigerator rebate and a dishwasher rebate for us. Looking for ways that we could get energy efficiency delivered to our customers. Quickly, though, our member co-ops remind us that they don't all have Best Buys. They have Ma and Pa hardware stores throughout their service territory. So we provided similar programs for all the Ma and Pa hardware stores in our service territory as well. We established a lead loan program. You probably know that Great River Energy has one of the few platinum certified lead buildings in the country. And when we introduced that building to the public, we also introduced a lead loan program of $20 million. And for any customer of ours that would like to build a lead building in our service territory, we'll finance the incremental cost of building that lead program at zero or low percent interest. We also, at the same time, established an Energy Efficient Equipment, or E3 loan program, of $8 million. It's financing energy-efficient equipment into our commercial customers' homes or businesses. And it's really financing products that are unusual or have a long payback, for example, like ground source heat pumps or something similar to that. And so we've put together some programs that we hope will help our commercial customers. Jeff Haas mentioned behavior programs. We actually received one of those R&D grants from the state of Minnesota, and we're working on a pilot energy conservation program that focuses on customer behavior, because we're quite certain that we're not going to achieve the rebate or the conservation levels each year with rebates alone. It's going to be done with changing customers' behavior. And one of the things that we've done is we've cut this money from the Department of Commerce, and we're working on a pilot program that's with Conexus Energy and with Lake Country Power up in northern Minnesota. And it's being conducted by a company called Positive Energy. I encourage you to look at their website. It's fascinating. They're working with the Sacramento Municipal Utility District. And it really combines behavioral science and targeted market analytics to provide home energy reports to customers. And it's proven to motivate customers to participate in utility programs. We're hoping that this sort of strategy will actually result in energy savings, and we can claim it on our SIP filings in the future. There's a number of other steps that we're doing, and you can read them, and I won't bore you with those. But I wanted to just kind of finish with meeting the goal will continue to be a challenge. And at Great River Energy, we are really earnest in meeting this goal. We see energy efficiency as our first fuel. I think Jim Rogers, the CEO of Duke, calls it his fifth fuel. We see it more important than that. We know that energy conservation has to be the first thing that we do before we build power plants. Easy to say, not easy to do. Without large commercial and industrial base, energy efficiency occurs one house at a time for Great River Energy. And what makes that goal even more challenging is that in most cases, in those homes, we don't serve the two largest energy uses in those homes. Space heating and water heating are generally done with gas, propane or natural gas. So we lose those two big loads in homes. We're left with lighting, appliances, air conditioning, and what's called plug loads today. We're already doing a pretty good job on the lighting. In terms of appliances, we're trying to make partnerships with Best Buy and Sears and some others to get appliances into our customers' homes. Air conditioning, we actually partnered with Xcel Energy on a program that's called Quality Installation. It's not enough to rebate an air conditioner anymore. You have to make sure it's installed properly to really get the energy savings, and we're doing that with Xcel Energy. But air conditioners don't provide much energy savings because we simply don't run them that much in Minnesota. Now we're left with the plug loads. Plug loads are starting to make up about 15% of our energy sales in a customer's home. It's the flat screen TVs. It's all the DC converters in our plugs and so on. And those aren't easy for a utility to get at necessarily. One of the things that I really strongly feel about is an education program. I think the legislation lacks this ability for utilities to spend money on educating consumers on the importance of reducing consumption. If the legislation allowed for some sort of spending of money for education, there might be a way to reduce that consumption on those plug loads. I want to finish with just some things that we're thinking about in terms of if we could have a wish list on changing the legislation, some of the things that we might suggest. One is to recognize the importance of utility-sponsored consumer education. allow banking of conservation, just like you do in the renewable energy credits. If we had a banner year, and I don't know if we'll have one, but if we ever had a banner year, allow us to carry over that excess into the future years. Recognize the regulatory differences and the differences in customers and service area demographics, and allowing the legislation to make appropriate adjustments to different utilities. I think it's going to be more of a challenge for some utilities than others. It's depending on their demographics, and maybe there needs to be some recognition of that. Provide tax credit for commercial and residential customers for their conservation efforts, and if not tax credits, maybe increase sales tax or a sin tax on appliances that don't meet Energy Star levels. We need your help. You're putting all this on the utilities, and we'll do our darndest, but I think there's some other opportunities as well.
Well, you're thinking along the same lines we've been thinking along, so.
Great.
We're happy to take your input on this.
With that, I'll end my preaching here and take any questions that you might have. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Olsen.
Would you say that geothermal heat pump systems would be eligible for SIP for rebates for them?
Currently, ground source heat pumps are eligible for SIP, and we provide fairly large rebates for ground source heat pumps because we're so convinced that they're the heating system of the future.
Did you hear that?
Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to say thank you. You know, I think that we've got some good utilities here, and I know you guys are doing really good work. This type of stuff that you're listing here in these partnerships is exactly what we need. Get out into the community to start to educate people and get them involved and make it convenient for them to make the changes, the behavioral changes. And it's going to take continued effort, and that's why, you know, I agree with the chair. We want to work with you on these ideas, and we need that feedback to say where do we go from here, how do we modify things and make it more effective. I definitely want to thank you for the efforts that you're making. It's good to hear.
Thank you, Senator.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I would echo that with Senator Dahl, too, that I think you guys are doing some amazing work here. My question is there any track record or anything that you're working with along with the other utilities on consumer education? What has worked in the past? And do you have any new innovative ideas on consumer education? Because I do believe that is an area that we do need to tap into.
Mr. Connor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator, we haven't really had any discussions with the other utilities around education. I think there's a number of things that I'd like to do. One is I'd like to get into schools. I think we need to teach our young generation how important energy efficiency is. And we cover 60% of the geographical area of Minnesota. We have a real opportunity for ourselves.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
I received a letter from one of a little student in one of my small school districts, and she was talking about energy conservation and how the teacher decided to turn the lights off for a certain period of the day, and they talked about energy. And she thought that would be a great state law. She was like a third or fourth grader. But you know, you think about this. I mean, there does get them to think about where is our energy going, if we can go into the schools.
Madam Chair, Senator, I would like to develop a conservation corps, and it's a group of young adults. And if there's a stimulus package, let's take some of that and recruit young adults to have a conservation corps and go out and talk to these school kids about conservation.
Okay. Senator Dibble.
Thanks. I'm loving all these great ideas. This is stimulating. Two questions. One is an economic stimulus. What is the name of the company that's working out in Sacramento?
It's called Positive Energy.
Positive. Okay. And then I was interested in your statement about the consumer behavior activities and consumer education, and I want to know more about why you're not able to count that towards your efforts. I mean, I know that measuring that may be a challenge. Is that the essential challenge? I just reread the language of the statute. I happen to remember it because it had something to do with it. And it does include, it says energy efficiency means blah, 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 programs that target consumer behavior, equipment, processes, or devices designed to produce either an absolute decrease, et cetera. You know, the goal and the intent, at least of the chief author, I'm pretty sure, was was to be able to, you know, if you all are involved and it results in decreased energy sales, energy use, you get to count it. Measuring, I understand, is a challenge. So what sorts of improvements might we need?
Mr. Connett.
Madam Chair, Senator.
Through the law.
I really do think that the big one will be for us to work our way through this pilot program with Positive Energy and be able to show the Office of Energy Security that we can measure the energy savings. That's going to be crucial, is that we can show positively that there's energy savings occurring and that it's sustainable. Are we going to change a customer's behavior for a year, or can we have some proof that this is going to continue? And so there'll be a lot of discussions with the Office of Energy Security as we get into this pilot program, just to make sure that we're on track with this and that we're seeing the energy savings that we're expecting. Out in Sacramento, they're in some cases seeing a 3% energy savings per customer that's participating. If we could do that, we could meet this goal.
So,
Senator Dibble.
Thanks. That doesn't sound like a needed change in the law, though, and that's what I heard the testimony say, was that we needed a change in law. So if we need to be more specific about that, my door is open, my ears are open.
Thank you, gentlemen. Now, does Mr. Scarbuck also have a presentation? Mr. Scavel could perhaps come forward, too.
Madam Chair, members, good afternoon. Thanks for the ability to speak here this afternoon. I gave you all a handout. It's in your packet. I'm not going to go through it item by item by item, but I may highlight a few things here given the time. It's a two-sided thing. The front side is
just
all
just identify yourself for the record.
Sorry, Glenn Scarbacca, Manager Resource Planning, Great River Energy. The front side's all full of good news. The back side is full of maybe frowns or cautionary notes or red flags to think about for the future. On the good news side, GRE is ahead of complying with the renewable energy standard. We have in place enough renewable resources to achieve about 8% of our energy production through renewables. We have been complying ahead of the requirement of the renewable energy standard and banking the credits that we've generated through that. And with the banking, we have resources in the ground that could carry us through approximately 2012 or 2013. However, to achieve the 25% renewable energy standard by 2025, we're going to need another 900 megawatts of wind if we were to meet all of that with wind. So far, the bulk of our renewables has been wind. However, in addition to the wind generation that you see in one of these slides, we have some relatively small but interesting anaerobic digester dairy projects. And GRE's member cooperatives have over 70 distribution-connected renewable projects. These are small projects that consist of wind, photovoltaics, and methane generators. If I could switch to the backside and talk about some of the concerns that we have going forward or some of the challenges that we face. And Ms. White did a very good job of summarizing many of them, so I won't repeat what she has said, although I agree with all of it. Some of the issues that we have seen, challenges, are first off, the cost of wind. We've seen the cost triple since we did our first wind project, our first large wind project in 2005. That tripling was something that we experienced in the early parts of 2008 with the changes in the economy, this general slowdown. We have seen indications of price declines, which will, I guess there's always a silver lining even to bad things like the economy, and that silver lining, at least for us, might be seeing costs come down to a more palatable level for us. I'll answer a question that was asked earlier of Ms. White. The effect on prices, so far the effect on us has been minimal because we have been able to add very cost-effective wind generation at prices prior to what we saw earlier this year. And that has done wonders to keep the cost of adding wind reasonable for us. As far as what the future might play out, a lot is going to depend depend on how the economy recovers, how wind production, how the infrastructure, the supply chain for wind develops relative to demand, the general prices of commodities, things like CO2 values going forward, the cost of alternative fuels. All of those things will affect the cost of wind relative to other resources over time. Another issue we've had to face is timing of wind projects. Ms. White did a good job of describing the interconnection process and the challenges that that has brought for projects and the fixes for that that the Midwest ISO has been developing and are being deployed now. One other aspect that's affected wind considerably is the federal production tax credit. It's been a double-edged sword. The production tax credit has been extremely helpful in holding down the cost of wind resource additions for GRE and our members. However, the way that the production tax credit has been renewed in fits and starts has caused at times there to be almost a gold rush mentality in the wind industry, a lot of projects rushing to beat the expiration of the production tax credit from time to time, and that has caused price fluctuations and probably general increases in terms of risk. In terms of, I guess, a couple other issues, one is long-term viability of wind projects. You know, this is all still a pretty new industry for us all. And the wind turbines that are out there, for the most part, have very good reliability records, but they have not been in service all that long. And, you know, time will tell, I guess, whether the long-term reliability will be there that we hope for, as well as the long-term economic viability of wind projects over time. I also want to mention wind integration is something of a concern as we move forward. As we've gotten wind projects up and running and we're getting real production data from them, we do see that the wind production does not correlate very well with our loads. In other words, at our times of highest load, we tend not to see the wind production that we might like to see, and we see a lot of wind production at times when our demand is low. This has some implications for us. One is that market prices for energy fluctuate with the relative relationship of supply and demand for resources. As you get a lot of wind production occurring during times when loads aren't high, that depresses the market value of wind. As the amount of wind that is on the system increases over time, we may get increasingly into periods where our baseload resources that are really meant to be, were designed to be operated essentially 24/7 will need to be reduced during times of high wind generation and low demand. That doesn't sound on the surface like a big problem, but those units were not designed for that type of service, and so there will be some costs associated with making them do that. And lastly, we will continue to need peaking generation to take up the slack at times when wind isn't available to us. Now, none of those, I don't want to give the impression any of those are fatal flaws. They are not necessarily, but they are things that we're needing to learn as time goes on and as the renewable energy standard ramps up, we have that opportunity to learn. Lastly, I guess some other opportunities that we see, while I focused mostly on wind here, we are increasingly interested in photovoltaics. At this time, photovoltaics cost many multiples of what wind generation would cost us, but as a resource, photovoltaics may lend themselves better to interconnecting to the grid in places where not as much transmission would be required. And secondly, the solar resource lines up a bit better with our load than wind does. So this is not going to be a short-term fix by any means for us, but I think it's a long-term opportunity, and it is one that we're increasingly interested in. Another opportunity is storage. Storage would be an excellent way to handle the mismatch between load and wind generation. Storage is expensive from a capital standpoint. It has losses associated with it. There are siting issues to deal with. But there are some real potential opportunities, reasons to be excited about it in the longer term as better batteries come along, as newer technologies like ultracapacitors get developed, and so forth. Lastly, there were some questions earlier about GRE's resource plan and what renewables have meant for it. Our resource plan going forward is with full compliance with the Renewable Energy Standard and full achievement of the 1.5% energy efficiency objective. We would need baseload resources somewhere out in roughly the 2020 time frame or a bit beyond. Prior to that, our resource plan, besides adding wind, would involve adding gas generation, and that gas would either be peaking or intermediate. Which of those it is will depend a lot on how the regional energy market develops and performs. GRE doesn't operate in isolation. We're part of the Midwest ISO, which is an energy market that stretches across a good part of the upper Midwest, and we have to very much take into account developments in that market as we go forward with our resource planning. So, Madam Chair, members, that's what I have for you, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions? Thank you again for an encouraging report.
Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Scavel.
Madam Chair, my name is Kenrick Scavel. I am here today representing Darrell and Power Cooperative. By the way, if I do have a handout that might be handy, if you have a staff person that could distribute that. Just a little background. Darrell and Power is a G&T cooperative. We were formed in 1941. We're based in La Crosse, Wisconsin. We serve 25 member cooperatives, 20 municipalities in the four states of Minnesota, Wisconsin, Iowa, and Illinois. We have about 1,229 megawatts of generation, 3,000 miles of transmission line. Kind of put that in perspective, Darrell's generation, or load, if you will, is about one-third the size of GRE. The three co-ops that we serve in Minnesota are located in southeastern Minnesota. They're headquartered respectively in Rushford, in Rochester, and in Albert Lea. My handout, I wanted to touch a little bit on part of our role as a multi-state G&T. Because we have distinct renewable energy requirements in the four states we operate in. As you obviously know, 25% by 2025 in Minnesota. Wisconsin, current law is 10% by 2015. Illinois is 25 by 25, recently put in law. But note, in Illinois, co-ops are exempt from that. Iowa currently has no RPS requirements on cooperatives other than that we offer some type of green pricing program for members that want to voluntarily purchase. But with that said, you can see the differences are significant from state to state. But with that said, Darrell anticipates the likelihood of more aggressive renewable standards within our service territory, either due to actions in the other states or potentially a federal RPS. Similarly, we view renewable energy as a tool in our arsenal for reducing our carbon footprint. So whether we end up with a federal 25 by 25, for example, or not, Darrell is going to continue to investing in renewables as a way of reducing our carbon footprint. Actually, we've been pursuing renewables quite aggressively for a cooperative of our size and have set an anticipation of 25% renewable energy resources by 2025 on a system-wide basis, even though currently Minnesota is the only state in our service territory that requires that. It's our expectation that by 2010, we will be at 10% renewables on a system-wide basis. This means that Darrell will be well ahead of our actual renewable energy requirements based on current law. So we will be 10% by 2010, indeed, we will be in good shape for the 2012 target as well. Now, one thing I would like to talk a little bit about is Darlin's approach to renewable generation, which is perhaps somewhat distinct from the other utilities. And I'm going to break our renewables into two segments, the intermittent resources, such as wind and hydro, that are dependent upon weather conditions, and our biomass and biogas renewables, which act much more like baseload renewables. We have, on a nameplate basis, roughly equal amounts of the two. And so we're building our resource portfolio. Currently, we have 64 megawatts of wind and hydro in combination, and we have 60 megawatts of landfill gas to energy, methane digesters on livestock farms, and biomass production. I should make a note that the biomass plant actually will not come online until 2010. And you might find it interesting to note that the biomass plant is actually a former coal-fired generator that Darlin owned and sold some years ago, has been purchased by DTE Energy Services out of Ann Arbor, Michigan, and is being converted to a 40-megawatt biomass plant that will burn primarily wood waste and, I suspect, some agricultural waste. Even though on a nameplate capacity basis our renewables are fairly equally split, on an energy basis our baseload renewable resources will provide about two-thirds of the energy because of their much higher capacity factor. And our approach to this is twofold. One, to try and deal with some of the issues with intermittent resources that you can't dispatch at will. And the second approach is our goal is to utilize waste streams when possible for the benefit of our members. In other words, if we can utilize waste streams that exist within our service territory, take those waste streams, convert them to energy, that's a benefit for ourselves as well as our members. That's my synopsis of the renewable energy. I'd be glad to answer a question at that point, or I can go through my energy efficiency update.
So let's check. Any questions at this point? Okay, go ahead.
Okay. Again, on the handout, I put a bit of a comparison of the energy efficiency standards of the four states. Minnesota, as you know, has a 1.5% EE standard. Wisconsin has a little bit of a different approach. They have a process called Focus on Energy, which is a statewide third-party administered program, and cooperatives have the choice whether they wish to opt into the statewide program or they want to retain their individual energy efficiency programs, and you find cooperatives going either direction. Illinois passed a 1.5% standard recently when they did the 25 by 25. Again, the co-ops were exempted from mandatory compliance of that. Iowa, actually, that's a misprint on the handout. Iowa, for cooperatives, have a biannual reporting requirement, not a spending requirement. Iowa's approach is currently the cooperatives are not rate regulated, so while they report, they are not subject to any particular standards. Darlin, like most cooperative, have a long history of offering and promoting energy efficiency programs to our owner members. We have a standardized list of incentives that are used to encourage our members to invest in energy efficiency, similar to most utilities. Energy efficiency water heater programs, ground source heat pump incentive programs. We do energy audits and assessments. Energy efficiency lighting, both CFL and non-CFL. Energy efficiency appliances, of course, a relatively new program is incentives for LED Christmas lights. I've always found it fascinating that we see about a 40-megawatt load increase at Christmas due to Christmas lighting out of a typical 750-megawatt load day. Christmas lighting is substantial. In addition, Darlin offers a custom rebate program for projects that fall outside the standard list of incentives. So, for example, if a farmer comes to us with an energy efficiency project, we'll do a customized calculation on the energy efficiency that can be gleaned from that and offer a rebate that's if you will, relative to the scale. In 2007, just a little bit of an update, Darylin spent slightly over $2 million in Minnesota on energy efficiency efforts, resulting in about a 3.3 million kilowatt hours of savings. That equates to roughly 0.5% of reduction in energy consumption amongst our Minnesota members. In 2008, Darylin's spending went up to $2.3 million, specifically in Minnesota, on energy efficiency efforts. Our energy efficiency results increased to 8.7 million kilowatt hours of savings, which pushed us slightly over 1% for our Minnesota sales. So the challenge, of course, is moving forward from this point. We've had kind of a historic base of around 4 to 5 tenths percent savings in our or results from our energy efficiency efforts. Darylin recognizes the challenge and doesn't want to leave the burden entirely on our individual distribution cooperatives. So we're in the process of hiring a manager that will coordinate and enhance our energy efficiency efforts on a system-wide basis. And that's one of the points I wanted to make. This person may have been driven in some respect to responding to the enhancements in Minnesota law, but we're trying to do this on a system-wide basis. We don't want to segment our efforts on a state-by-state basis if possible. I will say, for your perspective, that the distribution cooperatives are finding the task of meeting the energy efficiency standards to be a much more daunting task than meeting the 25% renewable standard. Furthermore, they're suggesting to me that the task is going to become increasingly difficult each year as, if, you know, to use the proverbial low-hanging fruit is utilized. And so they are expressing more concerns to me about the EE standard than they are about the renewable mandates. I put those various state comparisons down in part because I wanted to reflect a little bit on the approaches the various states are taking to improve energy efficiency. And I just wanted to pose the question to you as committee. If indeed there might be some advantages to a centralized, if you will, third-party administered energy efficiency program, as opposed to each individual utility structuring their own program separate from each other. There could certainly be some efficiencies of scale. There would be uniformity amongst the state. Each customer in the state would then have access to a uniform program. Iowa, for example, is going through this debate currently. The Iowa Utility Board is promoting a centralized approach modeled after the state of Vermont. Obviously, this issue is generating a lot of discussion amongst the utilities, but I wanted to lay it on the table for discussion, especially because this issue seems to be such a challenge, particularly for the smaller utilities, by the time they ramp up staffing levels. The last comment I wanted to leave with the committee, I believe earlier today the Department of Commerce mentioned the MRET system has been put in place in a 5-state region for the tracking and trading of renewable energy credits. And I would suggest that there may be similar opportunities for a trading and tracking system for energy efficiency credits. Call them white credits, if you will, instead of green credits. And I would take that a step farther. Perhaps there's even an opportunity for energy efficiency and renewable energy credits to be interchanged. For example, in a given year, if a utility is running short on energy efficiency accomplishment, maybe they could exchange or utilize larger amounts of renewable energy in its place, simply to offer a little flexibility. If our goal is to reduce carbon emissions, both offer the same outcome. I'll admit, energy efficiency reduces overall consumption, so that continues to be the ultimate goal. But as you struggle for flexibility in working with utilities that are having difficulty. It was just a concept I wanted to lay on the table. With that, Madam Chair, committee members, I stand for any questions.
Thank you. I appreciate your suggestions, and I think that was what I was hoping to hear as we were receiving reports, suggestions about ways in which we might make this or facilitate further renewable energy or conservation and energy efficiency. I'd like to back up just for a minute to the renewable energy. And I see that Dairyland has used a number of different renewable options. And I'm wondering if you could comment on the cost differential for the various different projects like the biomass as opposed to the wind generation.
Madam Chair, I would say wind obviously is probably the easiest and most cost-effective typically, especially if you can buy a portion or all of a larger project, efficiencies of scale. As far as the what I refer to as the baseload resources, the landfill gas to energy projects have probably been the easiest for us and are relatively cost-effective. Landfills, historically, as you may be aware, are required to capture the methane gas. In the past, they traditionally vented it, I should say flared the gas off to simply destroy it. And so they have an infrastructure in place already to capture the methane. Companies like, I can't think of their name now, Waste Management, have almost taken to an art form the ability to properly handle the gas, run it through an engine generator set to make electricity. So we've had very good relationships with them. The methane digesters on livestock farms have been a little more of a challenge for us. The digesters have worked wonderfully. We got involved with some European technology. We found more of a challenge with the engines actually not holding up to the sometimes corrosive gas. The methane digesters tend to be slightly more expensive for the output, the energy, if you will, than, for example, the landfill gas to energy projects. The biomass plant, that's going to be a 40-megawatt plant. Again, the energy it's not competitive with historic coal. Probably is going to be more expensive than wind. I know what's going to be. I don't have the numbers off the top of my head. On the other hand, we're getting an energy component in addition to the capacity component there. In other words, that will operate as a base load facility, and so we're able to dispatch that at will. So that's kind of I would have to rank landfill gas to energy as the most cost-effective of those three, the biomass plant probably secondly, and the methane digesters third. Frankly, the farmers are viewing, in many instances, the methane digesters as a waste management system in which the benefits are much greater than simply the revenues they derive from the electricity sales.
Senator Olsen.
Madam Chair, I have a question. In Illinois, with their co-ops exempt, do you know how many of their co-ops or the percentage of or of their electric providers or co-ops?
Mr. Scava?
Madam Chair, Senator, off the top of my head, I do not. I suspect if you're looking at total sales within the state, it's probably a fraction, obviously, of the investor-owns that are going to market to communities like Chicago, et cetera. I could certainly look into that, but off the top of my head, I'm afraid I can't help you. We have one utility in Illinois, one cooperative, and so we don't tend to be quite as engaged as perhaps in Minnesota and Iowa, Wisconsin.
Okay. Other questions or comments? Senator Dipple.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I too, appreciate the ideas that are coming forward about how to make the efficiency regimen better. More usable. I just as a side note, I would be interested with the benefit of maybe a little more experience, so we really know what's working and what's not before we rush to fixes and solutions and et cetera. But the credits, I think, are very compelling. It's a very interesting idea. The interchangeability of efficiency effort and renewable is interesting. I have to think about it a little bit more. But it does hit on one of my favorite subjects, which I brought up here before, which is certainly in the realm of distributed energy production, localized, maybe a farm or a big box retail or a small area that's looking at some form of micro renewable, Senator Rosen's favorite subject. That to me is very consistent with the idea of efficiency. Mm-hmm. So you're doing some energy generation on site, kind of takes you off the base load demand, and that I think is compatible with that concept. So sure love to kick that one around a little bit more.
I remember having a discussion 2 years ago about waste heat as a renewable energy versus a energy efficiency effort.
I recall
and,
that.
I got ruled out, so maybe we can come back to it.
Yes,
Mr. Scavel.
Madam Chair, if I could add one additional comment. Some of the folks in our planning department that work with developing renewables, et cetera, have great interest in geothermal heat pumps, for example, and they really view it as a solar energy resource. The challenge we're finding is they're a great way of reducing energy consumption in the home because you get literally efficiencies of 300 to 400%. For every BTU of electricity you expend to move the heat from the ground to the house, you get 4 BTUs of heat. It's difficult to provide the type of incentive levels to drive consumers to be able to install them. If, for example, it was qualified either as a renewable energy resource or you could get more than 1 year of SIP savings or recognition for it, that would be a low-cost way to the state of perhaps getting more homes to adopt that technology. I know Senator Anderson had made comments about it's difficult to even get the level of incentive to get a consumer to buy a new refrigerator at $1,000. A ground source heat pump could readily run between $12,000 to $25,000. And I think they're great technology. I've had one for about 18 years, and good stuff.
Good. Senator Jungbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Mr. Scavel. Two things. I guess I'll kind of make a comment on ground source heat pumps, because one of my observations there in terms of cost, it tends to be a cost driver when they're not planned well in advance. And what I do in our firm when we help especially commercial developments that end up putting in stormwater ponds or other things, if you plan the geothermal loops alongside of that excavation, literally the loops that are the most expensive part of it become a very small portion of that project. And so the advanced planning is major efficiencies on the geothermal heat pumps. But my, I guess, latest thing I've been doing in-depth research into is anaerobic digestion, because I just think we're not utilizing that enough. And just on the, I guess, the macro level, is it just seems like everybody that's putting in these projects is adding so much apparatus to make them so efficient that there is no return on investment. And if you were to compare that with, say, China, that's been doing it very efficiently for 50 years, they have very little controls, but they understand the biology of the feedstocks, and they're supplementing specific feedstocks and things to get more of a natural efficiency. So to that extent, whatever information you might have on some of the systems you're putting in, and anybody else in the room, I'm just trying to get a bunch of data on some of these anaerobic digester units and how they're operating them, and what kind of returns they're getting or what kind of returns they're not getting, because I think I'm kind of onto something. And in case nobody's noticed, I'm very anal about analyzing all things and trying to figure out how do we move forward on a lot of these processes, but you need as much data as you can to come up with some ideas that might help in terms of incentivizing that.
There's just try not to notice.
Yes. It's all about statistics and data. Data's my friend. So if you could, if you have any data on that, I'd love to be able to get my hands on that, because I think that's where we need to go When I'm dealing with wastewater, any wastewater plant, for those that don't understand, we typically take out the class one biosolids up front, which is a great feedstock for anaerobic digestion. But you need to supplement that to get a higher efficiency, which gets to kind of the same thing as a landfill gas. And again, in my district, waste management has a very efficient landfill gas collection in Elk River that ends up generating electricity for about 2,400 homes. So we have a lot of energy projects in Elk River if anybody wants to go out and see them, from wind to landfill gas to refuse-derived fuel. It's all out there, and it's fun to have something close by. You can get hands-on and really understand the kind of things we're talking about here.
Madam Chair, if I could Mr. respond to the Senator. I'll give you the contact at Daryland after the committee meeting. I think the two of you would have hours of endless, delightful conversation.
Probably would.
When I told Neil I was coming to give an update today, he looked at my handout and reminded me that in addition to serving 575,000 people, we serve 600,000 cows, 1.2 million pigs, and I forget how many million poultry. He's very engaged in the technology pros and cons of various approaches to the digester. So I'll get you that name and contact.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Well, that brings us to the end of our meeting. We will continue on Thursday hearing from the municipal and investor-owned utilities and their progress toward the RES and SIP. Meeting adjourned.